Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, Chris Massini highlights the latest round of Spokane Arts Grants as he talks with artist Danelle Barlow. Also, I'll introduce Spokane emerging artist Taylor Jakeway, and Dan Webster will offer his reflection on a new film starring a true movie legend. Music today is from a recent KPBX studio session with musical and life partners Archie Chen and Rona Gouldson Chen. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. I'm talking today with Danelle Barlow, an artist, writer, and yoga instructor in Spokane. She's the recipient of the latest round of Spokane Arts Grant Awards, or SAGA. The grant will fund an illustrated book called Creature Teacher Yoga, combining her work in yoga with the Salish language. Danelle, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me first, where did the idea for this project come from, combining the Salish language with yoga?
Well, the yoga aspect came from my previous children's book, Bigfoot and Lightning Bug. And so I was previously going around, before COVID had happened this past year, I was going around into the Spokane public schools and I was doing book readings. And then I was teaching yoga poses along with the book readings to kind of help children get a little bit of the, you know, the hyperness and the edge out so that they would be able to sit still and listen to the story. And so that's kind of when I started coming up with the concept of using creature teacher yoga, was when I was teaching these students, when I was doing the readings. And then I also became a certified yoga teacher. I believe it was in about February or March of this year two for children. And so when the SAGA grant application came around again, I was like, wow, this would be so cool if I actually made another book, but branched off into the yoga aspect using these creature teachers, because I was seeing just so much interest and intrigue from the kids that were picking up the yoga poses in these classrooms that I was teaching in. And then my daughter is one of the students at the Salish school. And so when I was going there and listening to the language and how quickly she was picking it up, I just thought this was such just a beautiful relationship, you know, to add to the work I was already doing. And I just think it's so important, you know, for our youth to be moving and to just be connected to their breath and to their body. And so I thought, you know, this is just another beautiful way to include the language with, you know, a form of movement. So that's kind of how the concept came to be.
Yeah, and I'm curious, how is it different teaching children yoga than teaching adults?
Oh, it's very different. it's a little bit more free form. You know, there is technique involved, but you're not going to emphasize that so much because you really just want them to be, you just really want them to participate. And so I just really want it to be a very positive experience. I don't want them to feel body cautious. And so with the children, I'm using the animals as, instead of using, like, you know, the names that you would typically use for the poses in an adult classroom. Mm-hmm. And so that gives a whole other kind of meaning to it. And so I'll also include some attributes of the animal, perhaps, or some kind of animated movement to keep them engaged. And I want that to be a really positive experience. So as long as they're participating, then, you know, I'm happy.
I'm talking with mm-hmm. Danelle Barlow. She's a writer and illustrator and yoga instructor and recipient of a Spokane Arts Grant Award for a new illustrated book about yoga and the Salish language. So let's talk a little bit more about the book. So what's the format? Is it sort of a follow-along, yoga instructional, or is it a storybook, or what's it going to look like?
I haven't finalized everything I'm going to do for it quite yet. It is going to have instruction. The instruction will not be in Salish because that's a little too advanced,
sure,
for a lot of the language learners, including myself. So the poses will definitely be in Salish, and some of the really important concepts are going to be in Salish. But the instruction will be in English, and I'm going to keep it very simple so that it's very easy for the little ones to understand. And I'm just going to go through mostly different animals, which I call creature teachers as well, that are around this area in the Pacific Northwest. I actually probably will include a couple characters from my other children's books so that they can be a part of this as well. But I don't know that for sure it will necessarily tell a story, but I want it to be really like an activity book that can also include being calm and being present. Because I think from what I've seen in other yoga books for children, the breath work and the connection to nature isn't as present in those books. And so I really want to influence that and put that into this project.
And so, as I mentioned, you've received a grant from Spokane Arts to help fund the project. How is that funding going to help move this project forward? What does that mean to, an artist like yourself?
Oh, man, it is such a huge blessing because when you go into any type of a new book, because this is actually my fourth book, but I've had to fund my other previous projects in the past. And I came to a point where I could no longer do that because the funds go into, the editing and the layout is a huge part of making this book come to fruition. And that's not something that I am I'm just not a technology kind of gal, and I am not savvy in that way. So that is something that I outreach. And I use a local business in Spokane called Accessibility First. And so they've helped me with my other projects. And so they're a big part of that. And then also, having a partnership with the Salish School, I'll be able to help them out as well for helping me with the translations. And then also going into the cost of printing. When it comes to children's books, when you're doing full color, the cost of printing is quite expensive. So I'm going to be able to print some copies and actually be able to give some copies away to community, which I definitely could not have afforded to do if it was only being funded by me.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
And so so what's the timeline? When, if people are super excited about this project, when can they expect to see a book, and where could they find it?
Well, I have a year, but my goal that I had set was for before the kids go back to school next year. I would like to have it out by the end of the summer and then have it be utilized as a resource and another learning tool for kids that are also learning Salish or people that just are interested in the book. So I would like it out by, before the kids go back to school next year in September.
My mm-hmm. guest has been Donnell Barlow. She is an artist and writer. Her work in writing and illustrating has been featured in Spokane Coeur d'Alene Living Magazine, News from Native California, and Where Women Work Magazine. She's also a certified yoga instructor and recipient of a Spokane Arts Grant Award, which will fund Creature Teacher Yoga, an illustrated yoga book combining yoga with the Salish language. Donnell, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We've had numerous opportunities to hear the piano artistry of Archie Chen over the years, but next Monday on Opus 11 of Music That Matters here on KPBX, we get to hear not only Archie, but as well his spouse and musical partner, Rona Gouldson Chen. Here's just a bit of one of the pieces on that program, the opening of Claude Debussy's Petite Suite for piano four hands. ¶¶ More words and music from Archie Chen and Rona Gouldson Chen on Music That Matters, Monday evening at 7 here on KPBX. Thanks to Spokane artist mentor Denny Carman, we've been able to introduce various emerging young artists to listeners. Today, we present Taylor Jakeway, a native of the Wenatchee Kashmir area of Washington. Our conversation begins, as is my wont, with a peek into her early years.
Growing up, whenever I came home or whenever I was hanging out with friends, I always ended up drawing, ever since I can remember. I was always drawing something. And I think it started mostly with people and cats, and then it progressed from people to birds, and then just whatever I could see or get a hold of, I would draw. I had a bit of a kindred spirit with the arts with a friend of mine. She's long deceased, but she was one of the elderly that was in my grandmother's adult family home that she used to run from her house. Mm-hmm. This was back when I was a child. We were really close. She was like my best friend. I was, I think, 8 when she passed away. But she got me really interested in painting. I was always into drawing, but she got me interested in painting. She only did paint by numbers all the time, but I would just paint stuff. And she always was very positive of an influence with that. And so I think that's kind of where things started. I was the only person in my family that did art. And so I was already a little weird just because I was a total nerd. And I, you know, loved books. I would prefer reading books instead of going outside and playing kind of thing. So I was that kind of kid. Mm-hmm. After school, I would take an hour or two to do my homework, grab a snack before dinner, and then go up and just like disappear into my bedroom and do art. That's what I would do every day. And so,
well, that's a very definite and good start to a career in art. You went to Cornish College in Seattle.
Yes.
Was there a specific reason why you wanted to go there?
Growing up, I was always told that college was what you needed to have a successful career, is you had to have a college degree. Now I have a different view, but we'll get to that later. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to a good college that had good accreditors, good, you know, foundation, and could get me farther. And I looked into it, and I liked what Cornish stood for. I felt like it was where I was supposed to be, even though I actually applied to 20 some odd art colleges and they all accepted me. Mm. I liked Cornish because it was still in Washington and my family was mostly in Kashmir and Wenatchee area. And so it wasn't too far away from home to start out.
Ultimately, you transferred to Whitworth to finish your degree.
Yes. So I did have to transfer because unfortunately Cornish switched their program around and they dropped a bunch of scholarships that were keeping me there. I still wanted to be in Washington for a little bit because I still wanted to figure out what I was doing. And Whitworth had the same accreditors, or most of the same accreditors anyways, and so it was easy to transfer my credits. Mm-hmm. And they had a four-year arts program. And so I was like, okay, well, that should work.
Taylor Jakeway is very definite when it comes to describing what a university education does and does not provide art students.
I think the most important things I learned were about making materials archival, how to make your own materials, which is all cool. I also learned art history and a little bit of composition work, and then how to write about art. And I also got to like explore with all the different types of art. So that was kind of cool that I had those resources for me. But as far as my ability to render things the way I do, that was something that I already had going in, and I just continued to work on while I was there. And for the most part, my instructors just let me do whatever I want. So
good for them to allow you to develop if the techniques are not what they're teaching. I mean, the other stuff is good. It's really great to know, and it gives you lots of context, but it is it was basically up to you to finish up the development of your technique. Where has that led you in terms of the direction of your art?
Well, I was pretty naive going into college because, again, I thought that getting a college degree meant that you would have a kind of career already set up for yourself. So I was kind of naive with that sense. I think that partly comes from growing up in the mountains on a small farm in a small town where everybody just goes to school for stuff. Also, being the only artist, I just didn't know what I was doing. I wouldn't change anything about what happened, but if I could add to my education at all as an artist, I actually think I'd rather get involved with an atelier.
Mm-hmm. And for those who are not in the know, define atelier.
You know, you look back at famous masters of art in history, like Leonardo da Vinci, who ran away from home and went and found masters of arts and studied under them. That's an atelier. It's kind of like a school, but it's one or two masters in their craft who have pupils, and they teach them how they're able to render and see things and how they understand art world. It's also nice, too, because now that they're more modern, from what I understand, is they teach you about how to actually be more of a contemporary artist, how to be successful and how to advertise yourself, market. That's not the stuff I was taught in college, mm-hmm. which I really need now. Anyone who wants to go to college, especially for art, make sure you take a business and a marketing class, at least one of each, so you get some idea of what you're getting into, because it's important.
Let's get into your art. Trying to describe something that is intensely visual with words never really works out perfectly. But fill us in as you can on your art. What are key characteristics of it? What are the things that you especially like to work at and work with?
For the last show I did, that series of works specifically, I decided to go on a slightly different approach. I was always like seeking out something to do with symbolic art or conceptual art because I liked having art with meaning, but I still wanted it to be really aesthetic and I still wanted it to be really captivating with how it looked. And so I found out that I could mix the realism of the world and my fascination with making it aesthetic with concept using surreal art themes. And so I started researching some surreal art themes. And so I just kind of got into doing work that was based off of symbols using dream psychology and a little bit of flower language as well for anything that I have flowers in there for. Or sometimes, you know, it's nice too because working with surreal art themes, sometimes they just play around with words. I have a piece called Butterflies, and it has this woman opening a door in her stomach, letting out a bunch of butterflies. Kind of like that idea of butterflies in your stomach, you know, that kind of unsure feeling. So I tried to kind of capture that.
Going back to your training in art history, in developing your style and your technique, and also in kind of explaining it to folks like us who are interested in it, was there an artist or are there artists you could point to as having been influential from the past on your work?
Not in the past necessarily. Before I went to college, my only artist that I liked or knew about was people like Leonardo da Vinci. Again, very naive. The first artist to get me involved and interested with working on surreal art themes would be Louise Bourgeois. And she is, I think she's passed away since 2002, but I might be wrong. It's been a while since I've looked at her stuff, but she did some really interesting personal work, and I just really resonated with some of her stuff. And so I was like, what if I could do that in a really aesthetic way instead of a more of a creepy way, like some of her stuff is. She's most known for a piece called, I think it's Spider, and I think it's in France. Louise Bourgeois was probably the one in history and art history that started bringing me towards that interest of working with the human mind and art. And then, of course, I did look at Salvador Dali as well. His stuff was interesting, but I think my favorite one for sure is Miles Johnson. He does really interesting, really expressive, surreal art, and I love all of his stuff.
All right. And for yourself now, your favorite media are?
I've been working a lot in acrylic paint lately. However, I actually really wanted to get back into oils again. I've trained in so many different materials that I just go with whatever I feel like working in. I have to say, though, charcoal drawings, since all my fundamentals are back with drawing from, you know, back in the day when all I did was draw, I would say charcoal drawing is where my strength is. But I'm going to be working on a bunch of oil paintings pretty soon here and working on just building in perfecting what I can with the resources that I have currently available to me.
You have something fascinating on your Facebook page, which are these time-lapse photography records of your creation of a couple of pieces, which I find absolutely fascinating. I'm curious about how that works.
I actually just use my phone.
Okay.
There's a setting on my phone. It's just on the camera. You can slide over to video, but then if you keep sliding over, there's a time-lapse option. And then I just let that record while I'm working and I keep my phone plugged in next to my workstation. I have a free app called KindMaster, and it helps me clip all of my clips of the recording together, so they're really seamless.
For those who would like to explore your work, what's the best way to do that? Because I know you have a Facebook page, and you also have a website,
yeah,
yes?
I have a Facebook. I have an Instagram as well. It's just Taylor Jakeway at Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a Twitter as well. I try to post most of the things the same on everything. But I also, if you just kind of want to look at everything as a whole, I do have a website. The website's just www.taylorjakewayart.com.
Taylor Jakeway, thank you so much for sharing some time with us. And I'm fascinated by your art, and I hope to see it up close and personal before too long. Do keep up the good work. It's fascinating stuff. Taylor Jakeway has a significant presence on social media as well as a website where you can see her art. That site is TaylorJakewayArt.com, with Taylor spelled T-A-Y-L-E-R. You're listening to Northwest Arts Review on KPBX. I'm Jim Tevenin. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, never fear. Northwest Arts Review is available as a podcast from SpokanePublicRadio.org. Dan Webster is here and ready to tell us about The Life Ahead, a film that offers yet another chance to see the great Italian actress Sophia Loren.
Some movie stars are beautiful. Some are talented. Quite a few are both. Not that many, though, can match the dual qualities of Sophia Loren, the Italian star who began her career as a sex bomb, developed into an Oscar-winning performer, and retains a good measure of both even at the advanced age of 86. That much should be clear to anyone who watches the Netflix film The Life Ahead, which was directed by Loren's son, Eduardo Ponti, and adapted from Romain Gary's 1975 novel, La Vie Devant Soi, which was published under one of Gary's pseudonyms, Emile Ajar. Why Loren, who hasn't been seen on the big screen for the past decade, would agree to appear in this film should be obvious. It provides a meaty role for an older woman. Gary's novel has been adapted twice before, most famously in Moshe Mizrahi's 1977 film, Madame Rosa, which starred the great French actress Simone Signoret, and not only won an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, but also a Best Actress César, France's Oscar equivalent, for Signoret. Ponti's version follows the same basic storyline. Loren plays Madame Rosa, once a prostitute who is years past her prime, and now earns a living watching the children of those still walking the streets. The movie was shot in the city of Bari, which sits on Italy's southern Adriatic coast. Madame Rosa is a no-nonsense caretaker, and she rebuffs, at least at first, her doctor's request to take in a tough 12-year-old Senegalese Muslim boy named Momo, played by Senegalese newcomer Ibrahima Gueye. For his part, Momo, whose street smarts haven't yet hardened enough to put him beyond the reach of salvation, doesn't want any part of her either. He'd rather earn his way by selling drugs, which presents him a dangerous but profitable way of making a living. It's only when he is encouraged by a friendly shop owner named Hamil, played by Iranian actor Barak Karimi, to give Madame Rosa and life without crime a chance, that Momo begins to accept that fate may offer him something more than easy money and an inevitable bad end. So far, the plot that Ponti and co-screenwriters Ugo Chitti and Fabio Natali inherited from Gary sounds fairly pedestrian, something you might see done with no-name actors on the Hallmark Channel. But that same plot does offer a few complications. Though born a Muslim, Momo has no notion of what Islam even is, much less what his ties to it could possibly be. It's only through Hamil that he regains some sense of the religion, which Ponti suggests visually through the use of what becomes Momo's power symbol, a computer-generated lioness. In the Quran, the lion is a symbol of power, patience, and faith, Hamil tells Momo. You have faith, right? Faith is like love. Madame Rosa herself is a Holocaust survivor with an understandable distrust of the authorities and of hospitals, which is why she has constructed a secret hideaway, not unlike that of the famous Frank family, that offers her both a sense of protection and of solace. When she begins to fail, as the aged tend to do, it falls to Momo to care for her. And his newfound sense of duty evolves into his making a promise that he will do his best to fulfill. And following Hamil's pronouncement, the faith he shows gradually becomes a kind of love. All of this could have been done in an overly maudlin fashion, again as would occur in a Hallmark production, but Ponti dodges the worst filmmaking traits by refusing to milk the storyline for more emotion than is necessary. And young Gweye, who was chosen from among 300 candidates to play Momo, fills his part perfectly, angry and resentful at first, jubilant only when he succeeds at proving his abilities, but finally vulnerable and sensitive when confronted with the choice that life hands him. It is Lauren, though, who is attracting the most attention, and justifiably so. In this pandemic year, when producers are unsure about how to distribute their movies, Lauren is already the subject of Oscar talk. Such a nomination might have been a certainty had The Life Ahead gotten a theatrical opening, as Ponti had originally planned. As it is, though, the theatrical circuit's loss was Netflix's gain, just as it is the gain, too, of anyone fortunate enough to witness what might be the last performance by one of cinema's greatest stars. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about film and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 airs here on KPBX Friday evenings at 6:30. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Messini. We're grateful as well for the contributions of Taylor Jakeway, Dan Webster, also Archie Chen and Rona Gouldson Chen, who play us out with more Debussy. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.